Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome to Too Much Movie, a podcast that gets lost in those movies that are too much in the best possible way. There are movies aplenty, and episodes are cheap. Every working hard-on can have his own podcast, and in every podcast, a happy, modern family. You can have Chris Candy, Rob Belushi. You can even discover the work of L.A. confidant Jordan Harper. They say life's good in the city of the angels. We're about to find out. That's what this podcast will tell you anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Too Much Movie, a podcast really of a murderer's row of films that each of them could have entire minute-by-minute unpackings and examinations. And even the first film, I have actually pitched to one of the guests in our little quattro that is joining you today as an individual show that we could do minute by minute, but he's too busy and too talented and on to his own thing, so he's not going to be doing that. But today, nonetheless, we are getting bloody Christmas together. I have Chris Candy, Rob Belushi, and the writer of the LA Confidential pilot, Jordan Harper, with me on Too Much Movie to talk about LA Confidential. Gentlemen, welcome to this new show on One Heat Minute. What the hell is it?
We're figuring it out as we go.
That is Chris.
It's a fully improvised podcast with a set script, and the script is LA Confidential.
That is Rob. And people who know One Heat Minute Productions know Jordan Harper. Jordan, welcome back, my friend.
Hey, always, always a pleasure to be here.
So really what we wanted to do was kind of talk. We wanted to get together, Rob, Chris, and I. We had a meet cute about a year ago talking about Heat. It was almost like a famous unaired episode of One Heat Minute, us just shooting the breeze while these guys were talking while they were watching Heat together. We decided we wanted to get together. So this is going to happen every month that we do this. So we chose LA Confidential. Chris gave this.
Well, wait a second, Blake. I'm still sorry to interrupt you, but Chris and I were over Twitter. Chris said, I'm about to watch Heat. And I called him immediately. And I was like, same time. We'll do it at the same time. Yeah, we'll hit it at the same time. And you responded over Twitter, let me know when y'all are doing that. And we were like, oh. I was like, Chris, it's you know, the with the scrolls from Heat. And you called in and we all chatted while we were watching Heat. It was pretty special.
Look, it was pretty special for me.
It was very pandemic connection. Chris and I hadn't hung out for a while. It was just a nice organic moment.
Yeah, and I was mentioning earlier to Blake, like Rob and I have known each other for a long time, and we kind of have like connected over the last several years over like very specific movies, and like, you know, our friendship is kept up on Twitter by this, like, where someone will say like, oh, I'm watching, I'll be like, I'm watching Die Hard with a Vengeance. And then, you know, Rob will come back with like a hook, line, and sinker. You know, he'll just have like very specific, like, you know, one-ups in regards to these movies. And like, I just can see within Rob, which is great, like we both have this appreciation for these types of movies that I hope that we talk about a lot on Too Much Movie, where it's just like, there's so much body to them. And I think in watching them with one pass, like, you don't get the full movie, you know, and we were talking before the pod, it's like Heat is clearly a movie that you can easily do 1 minute each of a podcast on, and you still won't fully get it because there's just so much.
Speaking to the person for 166 movie, there's now like 181 episodes. It's still not done. It's still not done. If the right guest comes along, there will always be more to say.
Well, yeah. And it's just these are like remarkable movies. And so I'm just stoked to get into it because, yeah, LA Confidential to me, as I've been prepping for this pod, I've like been watching it and going like, Jesus Christ. Like, I think I watched it to like the last viewing I saw, I was showing my girlfriend it and I'm going like, oh, this is what LA Confidential is about. Like, I fully didn't even understand it until like then, you know? So yeah, it's just like and the only reason that was is because she was like, so is this because this person thinks that this is, and I'm like, yes. Oh wait, I just learned it for the first time right there. So yeah, this is perfect for a pod of this nature for us to get together.
And Rob,
it's one of my, I remember watching it when it came out, and it was immediately one of my favorites. And
where did you see it for the first time? Do you remember?
I don't. That will be one of many moments that we cut from this podcast. No, I don't. I just remember it being like one of my favorites. And then I watched it a bunch. I loved it so much. And then I got into the Elroy of it all. Right. I started reading the novels, and I started with Black Dahlia in 2003. And then I just tore through them and read the book and White Jazz. Loved it. And now I watch it like four times a year. But to Chris's point, yes. Watching it now, I'm always so immediately thrown into just like passive viewer on this movie. It's just such an enjoyable watch. And trying to, like you were saying, Chris, watching with a agenda, it's amazing how much the movie pops, you know, the symmetries and the character arcs and the lines, the lines of dialogue that are out of Elroy, and you know, just the surface versus substance kind of very LA centric themes. I loved it. Again,
There's a really good documentary that came out called Shotgun Ride Los Angeles. Are any of you familiar with that? It's it was my friend of mine had a magazine called Stop Smiling Magazine, Chicago, and they did a Los Angeles issue, and they had a supplement that came along with the LA issue, and it was this documentary that I'm blanking on the director's name, but he did the Fred Rogers documentary. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he basically did this early when he used to be like a producer for Huell Hauser. He did this one documentary. He's like the golden boy right now for documentaries. He's very good at it. But there's this one called Shotgun Ride Los Angeles that he did. And it is this like 90s take on LA culture. And it's got all these incredible Angelinos in it and Elroys in it. And he's a total freak. It's like his whole story is like him like pretending that he's breaking into people's houses and sniffing panties, and like it's fucking gnarly. It's so wild. And that was my early entry to Elroy, because I'd seen LA Confidential, and then I get Elroy, and like, you're right, Rob, like you do not get a movie like LA Confidential without, you know, James Elroy. And of all of his films, all of his books, like LA Confidential is easily the best rendition of his, because Black Dahlia was enjoyable, but like it's a confusing movie to watch. It doesn't definitely have that symmetry to it. It definitely doesn't pop as well. And like there is something, and I jokingly say it, and it's true, like LA Confidential is a Christmas movie. You know, it starts off like it's a very much a Christmas movie. And you know, it's like, but in its sense, like it totally shifts from that into being like this like whole other thing. But that's what gets me about the film when I first start watching it. It's like, it's Christmas. It's Christmas in LA, and we're all in, you know. And it really, for me, movies that have a tone and a world, Spielberg does it really well. You know, you get this sense when you're watching LA Confidential, like, I'm in LA Confidential world. Let's fucking go. And so I just am so excited to be talking about it.
Now, finally, we've got Jordan Harper, who, if you guys haven't already heard me gush about him, is the author of the LA Confidential pilot that so sadly didn't get picked up, but has now like got a cult life of its own as like a companion piece to this movie. And it's so awesome. All of our friends sort of gather around, and whenever, like in the pandemic, even there was like a screening, right, Jordan, that you kind of virtually attended. Was that right?
It was the Austin, the ATX festival in Austin. We were supposed to screen it at a big showing there in Austin in 2020. So that didn't happen. Yeah. So this year they didn't do the festival at all, 2020. And so this year they did a virtual screening of it, which was really interesting to do. But yeah, I did the LA Confidential pilot, Walton Goggins and a lot of other very, very talented people. And it was tremendous fun, and it is not a TV show.
But I've seen a good part of it now. It's like you just crushed it. Like you really like did an amazing job capturing the tone of LA Confidential. Like it feels, there's elements that feel like the movie, but then it's like it's got a whole life of its own.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I tried very hard, and you know, it's obviously we were working at a deficit doing it for network TV.
Right.
And the nicest thing, well, maybe not the nicest, but a very nice thing that somebody said to me, we did a screening of it for just like cast and crew, and somebody's friend came up to me and said, you know, I didn't notice there wasn't any swearing.
Wow. And,
I didn't either.
There isn't. We have some alternate takes because even for CBS, I wrote a draft that was, you know, really pushed the line. And so I have a couple of alternate takes, particularly with Shea Whigham, who plays Dick Stensland in the pilot. A couple of shitbirds that we were trying desperately to get past the censors. I actually have email correspondence between me and the CBS Standards and Practices people, because I have an early scene where a cop was supposed to say, "Hey, don't be a hard on," and CBS said, "You can't say that. You can. He can call him a dick, but he can't call him a hard on." And I said, well, they didn't, that's not, the phrase back then would have been hard on. And I tried like three, so there's a very funny exchange with me, like really trying to defend the word hard on. But you know, the truth is you don't need it. You don't need, you know, the language necessarily. This might not be the place to tell, but when I met Elroy after filming the pilot, I sat down with him at the Egyptian Theater. He was getting ready to introduce this movie to a crowd.
So cool.
And, this was after we'd filmed it, but before whether or not we knew it was going to be a TV show. And I sit down with him and a bunch of LAPD detectives, all of whom are dressed like they're in the 50s.
Wow.
And he introduces one of them to me as Phone Book, as in that's what he uses to interrogate people. And I'm not going to attempt a James Elroy impression, but he basically says, "So it's for CBS." And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "So you can't say..." And then he went on to list a long string of words that you can't say on CBS. You can't say on a podcast. You can't say with anybody.
You can't say them in 2021 anymore. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And I was like, you are correct. You cannot. So we were saying none of those words will appear on the TV show. And I think he understood, and he was very kind to me. What I did tell him, he would not like the pilot, which is my belief. And I'm not being shy about that. I just feel like, you know, he's ambivalent at best about the film. And that was an R-rated film that was allowed to do things. So, but he was very kind and supportive about it. It was just very funny to get there.
Yeah. He has an interesting
LAPD shitbird. Get out of here. I'll call your wife to pick you up. You know, I know we're here to talk about the movie, but watching that link you sent was just a real gift. Besides your other writing that I read this year, She Rides Shotgun and Love and Other Wounds, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. The incredible I can't wait for Everybody Knows. You're an incredible, incredible writer.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dude, I'm so into you, I'm inside you. Which I think I've said before.
This podcast has taken a turn.
Listen, Rob is going to push the limit of what we can say on podcasts in 2021.
Hush, hush.
We're here to kiss. Yeah, on the QT, very hush, hush. I'm inside Jordan Harbor. But the pilot, the one thing that I loved so much about the pilot besides, we chatted a little bit about what you did with Hush Hush Magazine and how incredibly interesting I thought it was. But the character, Shea Whigham plays Stensalyn, and I believe it's a little earlier in the career. Everything takes place a little earlier, but
right.
it was much better than the movie. Stensalyn is my least favorite character in the actual film. And in this, maybe he's less burnt out in this time period of his, and maybe it's Whigham, but I think you set that character up to be a thoughtful thug. Oh. And it really came through, and he's just a piece of shit in the movie. Yeah. You know, so
I want to go ahead.
That's it. You know,
well, the character actor who plays Dick Stensalyn in the movie is this guy named Graham Beckel. Yeah. Was a teacher at the college I went to. He's a theater teacher at Loyola Marymount University. And so he's just like kind of a character actor who's like worked his way through a lot of movies. But I know that his line of "this is for ours, Pancho" is so fucking crazy. in the Bloody Christmas scene where they're all like, we were kind of talking about like scenes and lines that we really like in the movie, but when he says this, it's so fucking racist and so fucking hard. It's like, what the fuck is going on? Isn't it? Am I right that he says that?
This is
for ours, Pancho.
Oh my God. And then, so I'd seen the movie and then I would be at LMU and I would see the act. And the funny thing with like really good character actors is they're nothing like their characters in real life. And he is like the most like loves theater person you've probably ever met, the most like creatively artistic kind of like he's the most theater director you'd ever see at a, you know, of course he teaches theater at Loyola Marymount. I don't know if he does anymore, but you go watch his characters and he just embodies this pure piece of shit. And that character, it's like, again, like, yeah, we
just like drunken gaze.
I love how he's sitting in the back seat when he's introduced to it. Just like, he's so lit. He's just sitting in the back seat, just swilling. He's swilling out of the box. Okay. And you're like, man, you're in the box and in the back. You won't even sit in the front seat with Bud, you absolute shitbag. Like, I really like him. I like him. I'm sorry. I like him in that moment particularly. That is, I agree that it is a crazy scene.
So I like the scene that immediately follows that, where you first meet Kim Basinger and like Bud goes inside, because that is all ADR, that scene. Like if you watch that scene, it is all ADR. The dialogue from the liquor store owner is so quick. Like, you guys better be here soon. Like if you rewatch that scene, it is so like off, because I've seen the movie so many times and I went to school for sound design. So I'm like kind of in that world. I'm going like, oh my God, this is a totally recreated scene. And it is just so funny to watch. I'm just like, oh my, it almost is. It's like, it's such a good movie, but that scene is like almost like The Room. You know, it's like the almost like Hello Doggy. It's like Hello Doggy. It almost kind of gets into that territory. But from there on, like the one thing I love about LA Confidential is like picking out locations. Hmm. Like, and that's what I love about Elroy is like, when I first read, I think I was reading Black Dahlia, and it was like he was talking about like driving down like Wilshire Boulevard at like 2 a.m. or something like that and going into Westwood. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Yeah, this guy gets it. And so when you watch his movies, like, you know, they're so L.A., like I'm kind of trying to pick. Oh, do I know where that located? Like, I kind of want to know where the liquor store is. And I think there's like a list. I'm sure you can find like a list that like pinpoints every location from that movie.
We definitely can. And funnily enough, I just want to jump back to one thing, comparison in the pilot really quickly. Walton Goggins as Jack Vincennes is better than Kevin Spacey. I'm saying it here. Not just because Kevin Spacey is an absolute horrible human being, but there's this a couple of scenes, and one in particular in the pilot, where Walton Goggins is sitting at a bar having a cigarette, and
right,
there's like the camera sort of does a bit of a slow push in on him, and he's thinking. And I love, I don't like polished, too shiny Jack Vincennes as much as I mean, I love him in the movie, in the context of the movie, but man, Walton Goggins has an ability to have like blustery, kind of overconfident charm and also torment. And when he's having that cigarette at that bar and you're just watching, like, I don't know, years of narcotics and investigations and homicide and all those things as an investigator, I'm just like, the weight of the world is on his shoulders. And I think that I love him for that, because that just, that wrinkle, those few extra lines on his face, that that's still like right, balding a little bit, and he's trying to hide it, but he just kind of knows that he's going bald. Just a couple of those little touches that Walton Goggins is so comfortable in his own skin, I just can't get enough of. Whereas I think that spacey vanity, although it's kind of works for the character, I don't like it as much as I would like Walton.
You know, I mean, first of all, Walton is brilliant, and he's, you know, the star of my favorite TV show of all time, The Shield. And I was so honored to get to work with him. And I agree with everything you said, and I agree with you that he's better than Spacey, but also, you know, I've said this before, but I feel like the movie LA Confidential might be the greatest book to film adaptation of all time.
Yes.
Because I don't think it's better than the book, because I think the book is one of the greatest books of all time, but they do a nearly impossible task, which is to translate this gargantuan novel into a 2.5-hour movie while keeping that tone, that which is to me the essential thing about Elroy, is the tone that he gets inside you, and it's that buzzsaw. He hits you like a tuning fork, and then you vibrate the entire time. And the movie carries that off, and they rearrange the plot, and they have different people dying different reasons. They still keep all the characters essentially the same, and they also keep a couple of those amazing set pieces while rejiggering the plot and making it all work. But, you know, part of what they had to do as a necessity was pull things. And so, you know, the fact that Jack Vincennes is sober and for very good reason is something that's completely broomed out of the movie. And it was something, if you notice in the bar scene in the pilot, he is drinking a club soda. We were gonna do the whole, you see him at the end putting the envelope of money because he gunned down a couple of parents when he was hopped up on drugs. A backstory, by the way, stole wholesale for Basic Instinct. That is Michael Douglas's backstory in Basic Instinct.
Of course.
And so we were going to get to do all that. And so Walton, you know, in the pilot, he's great, but he was really feeling himself out because it's a character that is being held back, which is not the Walton Goggins that people normally see. And all I could keep, I mean, he was great, but I just kept thinking, man, when we get to season two and he starts using again, then we're going to get a whole new Jack Vincennes that nobody's ever seen before. So, but I do think, you know, you can see over and over again, you know, Dick Stenslin, I think you could say the same thing, is they only have enough time in that movie to give you two shades of Dick Stenslin, you know?
Yeah. And you don't really get to see where, like, that intense, you just think that loyalty to Stenslin is a purely a character of Bud White, the, you know, loyal thug.
Yeah.
Very complicated thug, which we'll talk about later, but you don't get to see that real friendship.
Yeah.
It's true.
You just got to leave stuff on the floor. And you know, what we were going to try and do if we'd gone to series is like mine all the things that they weren't able to put in this movie. And somebody should still do it. I'm available. The script's available. We'll make it work. But
do you want to tell, just before we jump into like really hitting our favorite stuff about this movie, can you please share with the lads? I know you've shared with a few people before, but I just want everyone to hear it, is what you would do retroactively if someone listening to this, and please get in touch, reach out to mail@oneheatminute.com. I'll put you in touch with Jordan. But if you had a crack at it again with some of that Netflix money that's kicking around that we hear so much about, what would you do differently? Because I think it's almost a stroke of pure genius.
Well, I have to preface this by saying, A, me from 5 years ago would kill me when I say this. And also that James Ellroy would still probably come out and kill me if I were able to do this. But if I were doing it now, I would set LA Confidential in the 80s. And I would do it for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, the 50s were a really long time ago at this point. You know, when you're doing the math in your head, you might go to yourself, oh, you know, the 50s, they were like 50 years ago. But no, they were 70 years ago. You know, when we were young kids, we weren't into the 1910s. Yes. You know, like that cool 50s vibe that it gets farther and farther away. It's more and more meaningless to people, to the point now that basically the 50s are as far back from today. I'm sorry, the 80s are as far back from today as the 50s were from Ellroy when he wrote LA Confidential. So, you know, and also to the point, you know, this style of 1950s has been completely beaten to death at this point in the culture. I had a rule, and I got it from the movie, next time you watch the movie, they don't wear hats in the movie. And really? I had to have a rule on set. I was like, I don't want to see fedoras, because when you put those fedoras on, it just becomes, you know, pastiche, whatever you want to call it.
I feel like Black Dahlia movie, they have hats in Black Dahlia.
It's not as good a movie as LA Confidential. You know, I think setting it in the 80s, you wouldn't have to lose a single storyline. Everything that is applicable about Hush Hush just becomes more of a supermarket tabloid. You know, the cops are still racist. There's still people dealing drugs. There's still serial killers. There's still that weird mix of celebrity and crime and sex. Right. And I think it would be the only way to do it now and have it feel at all fresh to people. Now, again, I get that, like, people might think that sacrilege, I can't say that word, but that's what people might think of it. But at this point, having tried this, go ahead, Chris.
You said it right.
Yeah, thank you. Having tried it this way and not being able to sell it to, like, you know, HBO or somebody like that. And I'm very glad CBS gave us a shot, but I would be interested in trying to do this set in the 80s. In fact, like, I've talked to people about, if we can't do this, then let's just do an 80s, like, LA cop show, like, and,
right.
You know, set at with the Roxy and the Sunset Strip and all that stuff. So anyway, that's what I would, you know, try and do now. Although, like I said, I think James Ellroy, who's larger than me, I have a photo with him. he would just pluck my head off. So I don't know if it would work.
Have you ever seen
Would finally avoid the weird question of what the fuck are Red Devils, you know? People are constantly buying Red Devils in the 50s. I'm like, what the fuck? Is that speed? I mean, what is that?
I do think that, right? Is that, like, that is speed.
Red Devil must have been a speed. Yeah.
Right.
Well, then I'm into it. If it's speed, I like it.
But, and I think Ellroy was hooked on these, where they had, like, they had the amphetamines that were like a nasal spray, and it was cotton soaked in, like, basically amphetamine juice, and you're just supposed to smell them, and it would give you
like
a popper
or something like that. Or,
well, but like, it was a cotton swab inside a plastic tube, and you would smell it. But Ellroy wrote about this, that he would break them open and swallow the cotton, because that's how you got the real rush.
I'm not the girl who cared about money. I'm not the girl who cared about fortune.
It was Shotgun Ryan Los Angeles was done by Morgan Neville. That's the director. And Morgan Neville, yeah. And he and the Ellroy point that he would have is, and this kind of ties us into LA Confidential, is that in Shotgun Ryan Los Angeles, you get Ellroy talking about going to Baskin Robbins in Brentwood and seeing Mickey Cohen walking his dog. And I'm just going, like, oh my God, what the fuck? Like, because Ellroy, I mean, we have to get in the movie, but Ellroy's got such a crazy life, right? You know, it's like his mother was murdered, right? Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Or his father? Yeah.
His mother.
So he spends his whole life basically, like, this brutality that shows up in his, and from his trauma from all that shows up in all of his writing. And
you get this sense from the guy, like, he has this thing that came out. It was like a BBC thing on him called Feast of Blood, I think it's called. Are you guys familiar with this? Uh-uh. So Feast of Blood is a YouTube show. It was a BBC show, and it is it's like catnip for me. It's James Ellroy at the front of a table.
Feast of Death, I think it is. Feast of Death.
LA Confidential, the movie, is the best thing that happened to me in my career that I had absolutely nothing to do with. It was a fluke and a wonderful one, and it is never going to happen again, a movie of that quality. Here's my final comment on LA Confidential, the movie. I go to a video store in Prairie Village, Kansas. The youngsters who work there know me as the guy who wrote LA Confidential. They tell all the little old ladies who come in there to get their G-rated family flick. They come up to me. They say, "Oh, you wrote L.A. Confidential. What a wonderful movie. Kim Basinger was so beautiful. Is she a nice person?" "Yeah, she's all right. It was a wonderful movie. Oh, what a wonderful movie. Is Kevin Spacey really gay? Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful movie. I saw it 4 times. You don't see storytelling like that on the screen anymore." I smile. I say, "Yes, it's a wonderful movie and a salutary adaptation of my wonderful novel. But listen, Granny, you'll love the movie. Did you go out and buy the book?" And Granny invariably says, "Well, no, I didn't." And I say to Granny, "Then what the fuck good are you to me?"
Yes, Feast of Death, yes. And it's him and a bunch of LAPD officers, like off-duty LAPD officers, like sitting around a table at the Pacific Dining Car in downtown Los Angeles. And they're talking about the Black Dahlia murder. And they're just talking. And then Nick Nolte shows up out of nowhere. And he's just kind of in the back. And like Elroy's just kind of holding court going like, "Oh yeah, this guy over here, he thinks he knows how to crack the Black Dahlia murder." And then like you just sit there. And if it's like, if you want to like a good ghost story, fire this thing up on YouTube, because like it is so fucking fun. It's just like all these like big jacketed vodka drinking, scotch drinking, steak eating police officers just ripping into these crime stories. And it's just like amazing. The Nolte part is amazing because Nolte just pulls up and he's just sitting in the back of the room, just like listening, like, yeah, it's so. I don't know. It's just.
He was like, "I dated the Black Dahlia."
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
She didn't call me back.
No disrespect to Russell Crowe when I say that I think Nick Nolte, if he had been cast at the right time in his life,
right,
is the best choice to play.
Could
Bud
have done
White.
A great Bud White. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you hear Russell Crowe's audition story for because Bud White's kind of his breakthrough character?
Mm-hmm.
It's
the first American movie.
He talks about it and like how he like came here and he was just like not sure if he had it. Then he had it, and I thought he did a great job. You know, I'm not gonna be here to critique anyone's acting on these things, but I think he did a great job. But yeah, Nolte would have also done an amazing job as that character.
Look, fuck Nick Nolte. I'm here to talk about Russell Crowe as Bud White.
Let's do that.
Fair enough. Let it go. Anyway,
No, I don't mean to be rude. I'm just saying, like, if I love Russell Crowe in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think he takes, like, my favorite. I mean, upon rewatch, all of my favorite scenes are now him and Kim Basinger, hands down. And watching these characters expertly played. So, one, you know, obviously Lynn Bracken. I mean, I don't think I'm, this isn't something everyone hasn't seen already, but it just really affected me on this watch that Lynn Bracken is a sex worker who uses sex as her livelihood and is seen in one way.
Right.
With this glamorous armor over her, the armor of another woman's identity. Veronica Lake. And then Bud White is this thug who used, I mean, a police officer, the authority and violence of the police that he wears And it's sex and violence, but what they reveal to each other are tortured, brokenhearted, vulnerable souls that in a blink of an eye, like Christy was saying, they see it in that liquor store in the beginning. But when Bud goes to her house and, you know, he's still a bit of a prickly pear with her, and she is, you know, handles it totally fine. She is not unused to men being aggressive and rude and demeaning. But when he almost asks her out and she says, I need to know your name. But the one where he comes in.
You have a thing for helping women, don't you, Officer White?
Maybe I'm just fucking curious.
You say fuck a lot.
You fuck for money.
There's blood on your shirt. Is that an integral part of your job?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
When they deserve it.
Did they deserve it today?
I'm not sure.
But you did it anyway.
Yeah. Just like the half dozen guys you screwed today.
Well, actually, it was only two.
And like you see this honesty in Bud White, and she's just broken through to him. And this has become the most, and their performances are so great because they go, you know, this theme I kept picking up that I really kind of focused on was surface versus substance, right? And they have their surfaces down, like when Bud White is upset that Dudley is giving him his job back to be a quote direct man, to be a thug, a brutal thug. Yeah. But he asks, you know,
Dudley, what do you want?
What do you want?
Call me Dudley. Call me Dudley. Dudley, what do you want?
A man of your talents lies elsewhere. Yeah. But he's able to come and say, you know, do you understand me? Do you read me? He says, you know, in Technicolor, sir. And he like snaps out of that and his armor goes back up. I just love these two actors in these two roles. Kim Basinger is amazing. You fall in love with her, but you know, she also just is everything. She's everything that all the movie star. But one last line became my favorite of the movie. And I know I tweeted it at you guys, but the girls in Bisbee need a little glamour. Yes.
The girls in Bisbee need a little glamour.
It's one line that does for her character what Bud White's whole story about watching his mother being beaten to death. It's her whole origin story. You just see a young girl and how far away from that young girl she's gotten and what she's learned along the way to bring back to what may be a young girl still back in Bisbee, Arizona. And you just see a lifetime in a line to me. I think she's amazing.
The other line to me for her is,
we still get to act a little.
He doesn't abuse us. He invests for us. And thanks to Pierce, we still get to act a little. Yeah.
You talk about her honesty. She's so great because their currency is honesty to each other. They get all the cut through, everyone with bluster and everyone trying to rise through the ladder. But that line aches. That line hurts. I still get to act a little.
Yeah.
Like, my God, that's the story. That's the story. You're the archetype for that.
Oh, no, everyone's got their internal struggle in regards to, like, it's very clear what everyone's fighting. You know, the movie does a really good job at basically taking complex character structure, and you can kind of pinpoint everybody.
Yes.
Really quickly. And I you know, not to pivot from that relationship, but can we also just, like, talk about, like, fucking David Strathairn?
I love Pierce Patchett. Holy shit.
He's like a favorite actor of mine who, like, totally just, but he's just so undeniably great as Pierce Patchett. And, like, you need that Pierce Patchett story because it's, like, the sex and the weirdness and, like, what is going on there. And the fact that that's sewn into your story is just incredible.
Chris, can I use that segue to say one of my two favorite lines in this movie?
Jesus fucking Christ.
No, Mr. White, Pierce Morehouse Patchett.
Like, I can't get enough of that. And I feel like I almost want to start taking that in my own language. Like when people say Jesus fucking Christ. No, it's Blake Henry Howard, actually. You know, just it's yeah.
In the book, I think that's a Lynn Bracken line. That uses that. Yeah. Which I mean, that's the thing about this dialogue is so rich that, like, when I was writing this script, I would literally, when I got stuck, I would open up to a random page and find some piece of language that you could just steal from. I just love, I mean, you talk about favorite lines, it's such a small thing, but when Bud White's throwing the dirty DA out the window, and he has a whole tirade, but the first line of it is just, here's the juice. it's such a good line reading from Russell Crowe, and there's just so many little things. If we're going to talk about the cast, obviously, like, the main cast is incredible. The other thing about this movie is it has an incredibly deep bench of character actors who are given. I mean, Strathairn, he's in more than one scene, but really he only has one real scene that he gets to work with. But there are people I really, and she is, doesn't even have her picture on IMDb.
I know who you're gonna say.
Mrs. Lefferts.
Mrs. Lefferts.
Wait. I was gonna bring her up, dog.
I know you too well, Jordan Harper. I know you too well. We've talked too many times.
She's so good.
She's amazing,
dude.
She's like she's straight out of the Coen Brothers. Like, she's just.
We were never formally introduced.
Yeah.
I mean, don't go in there.
Yeah. She is so good. The other one, and Blake, you probably know this one too, is the medical examiner.
Oh, yeah.
Where reading the
one of my favorite lines in the movie is his line,
nobody was a cop. You probably tried to do something.
That's exactly the line I was going to bring up. It's so, there's so much.
I'm so sorry.
No, but it's so good. There's so much disdain in his voice when he says that, the idea that somebody would try and do something.
Because these are men of action and they're fucking idiots. I mean, that's what I read. He doesn't even look up at Bud when he walks in. You don't even see his face. He's covered. His face is obscured by his work. It's incredible.
Well, and he throws out, you know, when Exley comes to talk to him, he does throw out, like, about Bud White, probably the biggest compliment he can give, which is he's not as dumb as he looks, or something like that. That's it. You know,
right?
From someone who is coded as an intelligent person, you know.
Yes.
I have to address the elephant in the room, the Australian elephant in the room. But this movie is honorarily Australian, right? Because we have Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce, who, like, shot out of cannons and appeared in this movie together. And so it was a cultural event in Oz, because these two Aussie, you know, Russell Crowe, New Zealander, and then Aussie sort of adopted, you know, Guy and Guy Pearce, like, as Aussie as it gets, you know, they're fired out of the cannon. You know, one is Romper Stomper. The other one is Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And they come over and they're in this movie, and it's just an incredible connection that they have. And if I was to just say something, honestly, I deeply regret that at no other point in their career, those two lads have not popped up together. Like, to face off or something, you know? Like, people always fan cast Heat, but, like, I want to see those two guys in another movie together, because it just feels like by the end, whether they're antagonizing each other or whether they're, you know, joining forces and their energies are balancing together, I just can't get enough of their chemistry. So, Guy Pearce is just pitch perfect Exley in this to Crowe's Bud White. I can't get enough of Guy Pearce in this movie.
And
support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A relationship beside... It's their relationship and the Bud and Lynn relationship that fuel the movie. Vincennes is kind of isolated. I mean, he's with Sid Hudgens a little bit, and they manipulate and exploit people. And then he gets Exley to manipulate and exploit the boxer, who is also an incredible performance who pops up. I'll just tell you, he's bad anyway. Tracking their relationship through the film is incredible to the point where at the end, where so much, like one of the greatest epilogues in any movie ever, you know, you just want to see it go. But in the end, when they shake hands and just look at each other's scars and nod at each other, obviously Bud White's been shot through the face, so he's not going to say much, but they just look at each other, take note of what they've been through. And, you know, Lynn Bracken's like, some men get the world, others get an ex-hooker and a trip to Arizona, which is another fantastic kind of resolution line. But I love the moment that they share a laugh finally, and it's,
all I ever wanted was to measure up to my father.
Now's your chance. He died in the line of duty, didn't he?
Ed smiles at him, and then that's when they're like physically in sync. He's throwing the gun through the wall, the empty wall, throwing clips at one another. It's mm-hmm. like a ballet, how they cover each other's, you know, six in that shootout when Bruning and Carlisle and all those guys come through the windows and through the floor. It's a crazy thing, because these guys couldn't get further apart when they're putting the young lady, I'm forgetting the character's name, I'm so sorry, the victim from Boyle Heights, into the emergency room, and Exley is like needling her for you know facts about who assaulted her.
And then Bud gets up in her face.
And it takes I counted seven guys holding Bud White back from beating the shit out of Ed Exley. And right in the middle of both of them in that shot when they square off is Dudley Smith, is the perfect Pierce Patchett. Is, and I'm so sorry I'm going on long, Pierce Patchett is so fantastic. Fine, Philip, thank you. My favorite line out of his. He calls his bodyguard by their first name and is so overly polite to him. The mustache does so much work, but he's such a great red herring for villain, because the ultimate villain is the man who can manipulate surfaces and substance the best in the film, which is Cromwell. And what he tells Vincennes, when he's about to do the interrogation, the lad will surprise you. And sure enough, he is surprised in the end by the lad. There's so much symmetry in the film, and it's all full circle. But Cromwell, this is my favorite Cromwell ever. And to me, after reading the books, like a perfect Dudley Smith, and so angular and patrician, but also glad-handing and genial with his boys. Anyway, I got a little excited. I'm so sorry.
He will also like to
show this.
How confused he looks when a dying Kevin Spacey says Rollo Tomasi. Like the look on Cromwell's face is like, what? And it's like,
I love that you said that scene, because also I love that he's in his Jimmy James and a robe.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of the shock.
Oh,
it's so hard. Like, what's devastating is how many times you chase the dragon for the shocks in your favorite movies. Like, when I saw that in the theater, I just couldn't have imagined that Dudley Smith was going to shoot him. I couldn't imagine it. And when it happened, I was like, like, there was a gasp. And I'm still chasing that feeling every time I watch this movie. And I think if I just focus, like I just try and forget or let it passively wash over me, as you said, Rob, like this is a very great way you can passively watch this movie. It can be a great background. But I just can't get enough of his unassuming posture and his clothes. And then bang, it's just right in your face. And that scene is just ruthless.
Yeah.
And his five daughters are out of town when Vincent comes.
I know.
The lady and my five daughters are all out of town.
I have to talk about, too, it's like an interesting thing with police dramas, too, because like the other theme in this movie is like the incredible racism that was going on during that time that still exists. Like, and that's one of the things that also hits me, like the interrogation scenes are so brutal. Like you're just kind of watching them and you're going like, holy fuck, like, you know, this theme is like still crack. Like, you know, it's like, and I think that that's what's like, you know, I think sometimes there's writers like, you know, and people who are kind of like telling stories like an Elroy. And that's one of the things I love about Elroy is he's like all about the brutality of every angle of, the, you know, these forces. And it's like I was working on a cop script and then I came to kind of realize like the history of cop scripts and like how embedded, and this actually soaks into like, you know, the whole Kevin Spacey character is so true. Badge of Honor existed. Like, you couldn't make a cop show in Hollywood unless the LAPD oversaw your cop show. You know, so they were basically kind of saying like, well, this is how it's going to go. And it's so interesting to kind of like, you know, when you watch it, you're going like, and that's what I love about Elroy is like, he was able to really like give you a very solid kind of slice at how, you know, rough shit was and like how gnarly LAPD was. And like, and just in like a sense of like, you know, all is true. You know what I mean? It was just like I in the rewatch of this, I kept on kind of going like, it was difficult to see then, and it's still fucking difficult because, you know, this like trope within the script is like, it was so like real. It's like, damn, this is fucked up. Like, you know, I guess it really speaks to like what I'm getting at in all of this is like the complexities and the like realities of an Elroy script, you know, of an Elroy story, excuse me.
One thing that I think is interesting, a big change that they do from the book to the movie is in the book, everybody knows that Dudley Smith is corrupt.
Right.
Dudley Smith is openly racist in the book, but not just openly racist, he's openly corrupt. And the assumption that Elroy makes that a movie, a Hollywood movie can't make is, well, yeah, everybody's corrupt. He's just corrupt on a level nobody can expect. So it's still an incredible shock to them that he did the Night Owl killing. But the fact that you know, if the movie had portrayed him as a guy who took bribes and like watchdog drug deals and all that and was openly racist, then that scene with Kevin Spacey wouldn't work because the audience would go, well, yeah, he's
no reveal.
He's a bad cop.
Shit.
Yeah. And Elroy is much more comfortable, you know, in the books, much more comfortable. Jack Vincennes in the book is also notably racist.
Yes.
In a way that is excised. I mean, they all are a little, but Vincennes really pushes it. And again, it's just Elroy would say, well, that's what it was. So that's what I'm going to portray. And all these cops are dirty the way that, you know, forgive me, but like all cops are comfortable with watching other cops take food on the sleeve more or less. And there's a cultural behavior that in the real world is very accepted, but that it's very difficult to portray on screen, particularly if you want the audience to think Dudley Smith isn't the villain of the movie. So I think that's a very interesting, and I think for the movie, the correct change to make is to, and lean in and let him be that friendly guy that you just think is the nicest guy in the world.
But Curtis Hanson, who directed this, adapted it with Brian Helgeland. And I think what you just said there is you then see, once you rewatch it, you rewatch all of the Victory Motel scenes of the beatings and the brutality. They cast in a beautiful new light instantaneously. Mm-hmm. So like it's not as overt with the bribes and the badness. But then you see all those scenes as a guy who's protecting his patch as the person who's now dealing drugs in Los Angeles, as opposed to trying to weed out who is going to be the next person or to squash any potential like people rising up. Like it just like changes the intent of those nicely. I do have to shout out one person who makes this movie for me so amazing, Dante Spinotti.
who is the cinematographer.
Oh, yeah.
The great Dante is obviously the cinematographer of movies like Heat and The Insider and Thief. He's just brilliant. And this movie, like, I've said it a couple of times, but, like, he makes this movie look so good that it makes other movies look. Like, if you compared De Palma, who's an amazing filmmaker, and Curtis Hanson, sure, you know, arguably if you pair them together, like, they're both so amazing. But, like, Dante Spinotti shooting this, and then, like, whoever shot, I'm not sure who the cinematographer is. I'll have to look that up, of, like, the Black Dahlia. Yeah, Zygmunt, that's who it is. Yeah, so I'm just like, I'm sorry, but Dante just got it. It just looks like L.A. Mm-hmm. Like, it, like, well, it's
but that's
just,
a very,
so amazing.
Yeah, like, but that's a huge thing, right? Like, L.A. is the biggest character in this movie. I mean, of course, L.A. yes. Confidential, but, like, but I think that that's also a thing, like, that Rob and I really, like, gel on is, like, L.A. movies, you know? And it's, like, there, it plays such a character in so many movies, but you can also kind of, like, have it be a character, but it's not there, you know? It's playing
yes.
backup,
yeah.
And it's, like, you know, yeah, this movie so vividly just, like, grabs you. And it, like I said earlier in the show tonight, it was, like, I want to know where Pierce Patchett's house is. Have I driven by it? Like, where is the, you know, I think I went by the Night Owl. Did I go by the Night Owl right now? Like,
I want to know where the Night Owl is. Yeah, I want to go. Yeah, it's probably in, like, Azusa or something.
Yeah. My,
but it's true, because quickly about Spinotti, he got me on this last rewatch when they shoot the Mickey Cohen's drug lieutenant with all the heroin, and the glass falls out, and it's the guys across the the pool. It yeah. holds, and you just see the gun smoke wisping in a circle. And I feel like Hansen was, like, watching and holding, and he was just like, "God damn it, Dante, he got me. We got to leave it in. It's so beautiful. It's like deep background." Smoke billow, like, we hold on it for no reason other than to, like, absorb the moment. And
wait,
then,
that was that's the same cinematographer of Heat.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that scene always—I didn't know this. That scene always reminded me of the glass breaking scene in Heat with the hockey scene when he's walking. Like, those two scenes always remind me.
Yes,
the same scene.
Yeah. So it's the amazing scene where the shape charge blows out all the windows, and then there's a bit of tinsel that falls down in front of Easy Financing, which is the car financing business that's behind the car lot. And we always talk about that moment of the tinsel falling, the breath after the explosion, and the patience to do that. And it's a very, like, I hadn't thought too much about it before, but, like, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, we're going to hold. And then you give him the option, and, like, Curtis Hanson's like, this is actually awesome. This is actually awesome. We're going to do it this way.
I mean, the scene you're talking about when Van Zandt gets killed,
yeah,
Candy,
yeah,
yeah, amazing. And the similar fall, I texted, we were in Las Vegas at the pool, and I texted Blake, like, Bill Fichtner was just, like, chilling by the pool, and I never bother anyone, and I was just, like, walked up to him, and I was like, Roger Van Zandt, big fan, and he was like, get the fuck away from me. And I'm like, cool. Cool, man. Enjoy your day. We're all here fucking, you know, buying our own Barabons back. I get it. Sometimes you got to buy your own bag, you know?
Rob, you truly do the Lord's work.
Shittiest moment of my life. Like, growing up, like, around, I just, he, to that character to there me are, is.
There are those ones.
Snake.
Right? Yeah. There are those ones. Yeah,
oh,
I also have to say, with LA Confidential real quick too, like, and this gives a nod to another character we haven't talked about at all, but, like, the fucking intro to this movie is epic. Like,
it's everything.
It's also, in fact,
you could just play the intro and the end, and the whole thing, you don't even need the rest of the movie.
Well, you know, it's the pitch. It's literally the pitch that he did when he pitched the movie to executives. He brought that collection of photos and showed it to him and said, this is the movie, and then literally turned that into,
because as, like, an LA
and
maniac, Danny DeVito's voice
is everything in that too,
but the song, like, all three of our characters are Mr. In Between, like our main characters. It just sets them all up. What they're in the middle of is different for each one. And then, Chris, to your point, this movie is about LA. It's about the story that is fastened on to the reality of life that covers, you know, all of all the dark recesses that, you know, that we fight through, and the juxtaposition of like the machinery of LA and the derricks by the Victory Motel and the constant typewriting sound over everything. It's very just very created in the flashbulbs throughout, not just the paparazzi, but also the Mickey Cohn, and then the a great moment of that, of like the metaphor of the sheen on the shit, is when Exley is like, he's whining to Dudley, like he's his daddy or something. He's like, it's my case. I got the call. He's like, you don't want it, Edmund, and you can't have it, but you can be my second in command. And then the camera, and then they both immediately turn to the camera and it pops, and like, they're fine. They're working together after this extreme, you know, this very serious confrontation. I mean, that's the whole movie.
But that's also, I wanted to bring that up to pin it back to Jordan too. Like, so I've been so into Audible, right? And like, I've just been listening to LA Confidential. Like, I haven't worked all the way through it, but like, just like be driving around LA and like listening to the Audible version of LA Confidential. And the scene where Dudley is talking about, are you willing to be, you know, a person, you know, all of that stuff. Like, that scene is, you know, I clearly remember from the book, but that one translates from your pilot and was also very clearly in the movie. And that scene sticks out to me so well. Like, it's just, it sets it up so exact to like what LAPD is doing at that time. Like, are you down? Well, if you're not, for heaven's sake, son, don't become,
I was going to bring this scene up too, because I've always been a fan of that kind of precise writing where something just clicks together. And I mean, maybe this is so basic, it's not even worth noting, but every question that Dudley Smith asks Ed Exley is what he does at the end of the movie. Everything he says he will not do in that scene is a thing he does at the end of the movie, including shooting somebody in the back if you know them
to
be guilty.
It's the symmetry.
It's perfect. It's that kind of like writing that some people might find like too precise, but to me, that's just, it's just beautiful. And it is just the basic question of, you know, you read in any kind of you know, book or movie about this sort of stuff. I'm reading John le Carré right now. It's always the same thing of like,
sorry, Jordan, I have to say, does he, you just like blew my mind a little bit with that moment, because it's something that I hadn't really thought about. And he even says, and for God's sake, son, don't wear the glasses. No one in the bureau wears them. And he's not wearing his glasses. Yep. That's so good. Oh, that's
no,
so
it's,
good.
No, it really is. It's a great screenwriting moment. And the other scene that I really wanted to talk about, and I just to flag it as truly special, and I know Chris brought it up from a brutality standpoint, but the interrogation scene with Ed Exley running between interrogation is one of the great scenes, both in crime fiction and in crime films, because I've written a lot of interrogation scenes, a lot of them with the third Australian from this movie, Simon Baker.
Simon Baker.
And they are very hard do well and make them interesting, because it's
right,
you know, other than like the basic drama of, you know, getting the truth out of someone, but to make them interesting. And I don't know if I could ask, and I guess I had my chance and I blew it, if I could ask Elroy one question about where do you get your ideas, which is a question not everybody likes, how he came up with the idea of running back and forth and playing select, you know, audio snippets.
Audio.
Was he just like touring a station and somebody said, you know, they could play each other. Like, maybe somebody told him they did that. I don't know. Even if he didn't come up with it from the ether, it's still a perfectly executed scene where you see both why people should be scared of Ed Exley, because that's how smart he is. And also why you should be scared of Bud White, who breaks it at the end and comes in and does the one thing that James Elroy, great American writer. He loves the Russian roulette and the gun never goes off. And, you know, there's one Elroy book, I think it might be in the Colt 6000, where I swear to God, somebody loads a gun with five bullets in one empty chamber and spins it and pulls the trigger. It still never goes off. He loves that trick. But it's just from a like technical standpoint of like, you know, this boring, the interrogation scene. And you get, when I did LA Confidential, what I tried to do is always por qué no las dos, or why not both? Like, why does something have to be an interrogation scene or just a character scene when you can take an interrogation scene and use it to reveal the character of the detective? And I learned it from Elroy, and I learned it from this, because that's what that scene does. It's you meet both the detectives in a way that you hadn't met them before, and you learn this incredible story, and it's revealed in this way. You are on the edge of your seat the entire scene of like, wait, what happened? Oh, I think I'm figuring out. Oh, if she don't die, I don't die. And you're like, wait, what? Oh, and then it all comes. It's just truly, truly a masterful scene. I just love it. That's what I'm here to say.
Yeah.
I also love the sound, because, you know, speaking, Chris, we were talking before about being audiophiles. I love the choices who you don't hear. Mm-hmm. So where it's the sort of second tough guy of those three guys that are in interrogation, when he's hearing what's being said, yes, there's that brief cutaway to him, and he's like, oh, like, no, like, don't say that. Like, he's like, he's looking up and he's like, no, but you don't hear him. It's like barely audible in the background. I love that choice of that moment too, like those little beats.
That actor is, I thought, did a tremendous job of going in a minute and a half from the proudest, toughest dude in the room, mm-hmm, to the boss having job. You know, yeah, exactly. To you know, whimpering Sylvester Finch's name, and like, he was incredible. And I wish, you know, to Chris's point, like, the one thing I would, you know, and Jordan, you've talked about this too, is whether it's period or not, what you put on the screen is still a choice. And they did pull back on some of the overtly racist language of the time, a lot of it. But, you know, I just wish the film, looking at it today, like, the one thing is, it is essentially the story of a white supremacist police force denigrating and manipulating those without power. I mean, it begins with the group of Mexicans, you know, it moves through African Americans and the young woman from Boyle Heights, and the Matt Reynolds, who is murdered and exploited, and D.A. Lowe, who is, you know, a piece of shit, but also like, under threat of sexual denunciation, he, you know, he's turned into a whip. He goes from a preening, arrogant, hubristic DA to a withering, bedwetting, you know, child on the floor in the face of all this triptych of masculinity, you know, and I don't have a conclusion on that. It's just, it's something I'm more thoughtful of now that I probably wasn't, yeah, was when I was 20, you know.
Well, when Kevin Spacey's character is giving the one actor the opportunity to get his brother out of jail, and then he gets the lead out of him, and then he goes, keep it up. It's like, oh, fuck.
It's horrible.
They suck.
It's cruel.
He does it again. He does it with Matt Reynolds. Pretend it's an acting job. Yeah. Brutal.
Yeah, it's like,
yeah, brutal.
Exploitation. Those two things are so terrible. But that's what leads up to one of the greatest lines in the film, is when Exley says, why did you become a cop? And he says, I don't remember.
Yes. And yes.
It's the whole performance in that one line that all that shit has been leading up to.
The monumental interrogation scene, great with characters. And then what's so funny is when they do go to D.A. Lowe, who is in his own, you know, quandary. But when he's like, what are you going to do? The good cop, bad cop routine. And it's like, once you've already seen the interrogation, you're like, oh, my friend, this is really not going to go well for you. And I can't wait to see what Bud comes up with, because it's going to be, whatever it is, it's going to be enjoyable. Even as a pure voyeuristic sense, it's going to be great. I love that low scene for that reason. And I think you're right. what's great about Elroy just satisfying us is that it's all ugly. Like, it's all this shiny Hollywood, hush-hush, glamour, all of it, right from the get-go. It's all ugly. It's all manipulation. It's all for money. And he's just nakedly candid about the human condition, which is why he's so voraciously consumed still to this day. And even Jordan convinced me to read American Tabloid again, which I'm now reading, thanks to us discussing JFK together.
I heard that conversation. It was great.
Did you guys do one on JFK?
Yeah, like last week.
Yeah, Jordan and I did a little discussion about JFK because we had to talk about
it's too much movie. If I can say so,
it's too much movie. Chris, you are like connected to the too much movie scene of JFK.
Oh.
One of the greatest scenes of the entire movie. Like, let's just be really clear.
Right, it is. It's a great scene.
Be straight up. It's a great scene. But yeah, no, so like, again, so that's the Elroy out of it.
Yeah. No, I think I think that's the best thing about this podcast is like, we're going to get to these elements. Like, there are these movies where you watch them, and LA Confidential is like the best example. And we just spent all this time talking about it, where it's just like, there's so many moving parts going on and there's so many things to pick up on. And it's just such a complex film. And I think, you know, as we've been all talking, I've been thinking about when you make a movie, it really is like, as we were talking about the cinematographer for this film, like, well, what was the problem with Black Dahlia? You know, the story's great, you know, acting's great.
Yes.
Like, what is the difference between Black Dahlia and LA Confidential? It made me think of like making a cake or something like that. Like, something is off there. And, you know, it could be the editing, could be who knows what, but with you know, Jordan, your point, this is a perfect adaptation from book to film. Like, I can't think of one better that really captures the tone of the book.
I think it's pretty difficult to come up with a second place.
It's hard.
I mean, look, I pulled out my copy of LA Confidential. I don't think, well, certainly the people listening at home can't see it, but I was looking at all the highlighting where I highlighted every time a new character is named in the book, and there are hundreds. I literally listed all like several hundred characters in the book. There are two serial killer plots in the book that aren't even touched upon in the movie. The book covers 8 years. You know, Inez Soto, the victim, is probably the
Inez Soto. That's it.
Yeah, an incredibly shortchanged character in the movie, and understandably so. It's tough to see how you fit her into this dynamic, but it is, you know, the one real person of color with any like agency or anything like that. They cut out the entire Disneyland subplot.
Yeah, that's what I was the whole like what do they call it in LA Confidential, like Mookie Mouse or something like
it's,
that.
It's Dream of Dreamland.
Yeah. So creepy.
I once wrote on my Letterboxd a very long review of why Black Dahlia is not as good as this movie, and I won't regurgitate.
I read that.
I have very strong feelings about it, but I think it's
salient. It's specific. Great.
No, you know, and I think that there are enormous number of mistakes, but I think the main one is they just don't get that buzzsaw tone. It doesn't. I think he is too removed a director. He's too in love with filmmaking. It feels like a movie. It doesn't feel like you're living in this world that you need to feel, which is why why my original conception for the pilot was like a Shield like handheld cam, but set in the 50s to try as hard as possible to make a world of the 50s feel like you're in it. It's a very difficult thing to do. I think you can see it in like the, you know, Ruth Meyer is the costume designer for the movie LA Confidential and for the TV show. And she's magnificent. And, you know, there are parts where like Kim Basinger is, you know, that dress she wears is incredible. She's gorgeous. But a lot of the other choices are very muted and laid back. Like I said, there's no hats. They make a lot of decisions on how to draw people into the world. I think the casting is very not great on Black Dahlia. Those are totally fine actors who are just not mugs. even the very handsome people of LA Confidential, the movie, are mugs in one way or another. You know, I mean, Russell Crowe is.
Russell Crowe's got, he's got dad bod. It's like the like he's exactly the guy you expect him to be. He's not going to be shredded.
He talked to his trainer about what should I do for this. And he goes, well, his trainer said, well, it's set in the 50s. Eat steaks and do push-ups and don't do anything else. yeah. And that's how he does have like a 50s tough guy bod. You know, everybody in that movie has a little like angles to them and weirdness. I really, when I did my pilot, I was always, we need mugs. I want every face to look unique. Again, you talk about Mrs. Leffert in the movie. You don't see that in the Black Dahlia.
You've got the wrong idea, mister. I'm fine. yeah. I love her voice.
My Susie was a good girl. She didn't do anything wrong.
But
I love when they ask her, is that your daughter? Is that your daughter? And she goes, I don't know.
It looks like my Susie. yeah.
She doesn't know because her
Ruth Myers knows. Is something so, I don't know if it's her or Curtis Hanson, but the thing with the watches in the movie is so interesting. Like, Exley's got a Rolex, which I can only assume his father bought him.
Yeah, and that would make sense.
Vincennes has the very nice tie and a Bulova, which is a much cheaper watch, if I'm correct.
I'm sure. This is all you, man.
Rob's
watch corner on Too Much Movie.
yeah, I don't want to kill my audience for What's the Time, new podcast, but that was Vincenzo's ties popping against the watch, the significantly cheaper watch, I thought was really interesting. And you brought up Exley's glasses, and I feel like you could do a whole podcast just tracking when he's wearing his glasses and when he isn't. And every time he goes to war until the end, like when they go in and find the Night Owl suspects initially, and then when he goes and becomes, you know, Shotgun Ed, he forgets his glasses both times. And both of those times he's caught up in the machinery of this corrupt plot that he is unknowingly in, even though initially when he takes the Night Owl call, he's not wearing his glasses. And then the two detectives in the bullpen walk out and leave. He puts his glasses back on. The call comes from the Night Owl and he springs to the phone and takes the case. So it's Exley, I think, is the only man in the bureau who has a different viewpoint on what is happening. And I know that's an old trope, glasses, vision, and all that, but it's singular. And I think to your point in the interrogation and what Dudley says, you know, he's a political animal. He sees it all in a very different way, which grows, you know. Ultimately, Exley has to become less arrogant and, you know, answer a few of those questions. He has to become more corruptible in order to find his place. Bud White needs to become more, you know, a little more moral, or let that be seen. And Vincent,
more discerning, thinking instead of just battering.
Right. Yeah. And Vincent needs to become, you know, have more heart, become less corrupt. Which is so
great.
Don't
you love how he's drawn into the fight because someone touches his tie?
Yeah.
Just because you were talking about his massive ties. Like, that's the thing that draws him into the fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you messed my tie up.
That moment of I don't remember, it comes after he sees Matt Reynolds, and that's when it all stops. He looks in the mirror over the drink, looks at himself, and all that glib smugness goes away. And he sees Matt Reynolds, and it's such a great moment of him just falling against the wall. And it changes everything. Like, I don't know. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm sorry.
You know exactly what you're talking about.
I wouldn't want to listen to Rob Belushi talking on this podcast for all the whiskey in Ireland.
I have to say though, that scene, the kind of riot that happens, Bloody Christmas, you see every character very clearly in that fight, you know, and that just sets it all up, you know, the do-gooder, the vanity, the, you know, I'm not into this, but I'll beat the shit out of you of Russell Crowe. Like, it all shows up really, really quickly.
I was just gonna say, you know, Russell Crowe, his moment of violence is because the guy says, fuck your mother.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And that's another
overdubbed scene. The whole scene, the audio is terrible. It must have been terrible because this is for ours, Pancho, overdubbed. And then he goes, oh yeah, fuck your mother, overdubbed. And that character actor is amazing. He's been in so many films. And then
he's been in like 5,000 films.
He was in the Jurassic Park Lost World. He got eaten by a bunch of dinosaurs. I always tracked him in that era because he was working so much, whatever his name is. Great character actor. But yeah, anyways, like that scene just, you know, it always stands out. And again, like, you know, this is a movie that, it just has that. It's got a lot of flavor in the bite, you know, whatever. Like you could do, and I think that this is the point of the podcast, that this pot, you know, this is a movie that you could do easily, a 1 minute pod version of each,
and
a 1 hour.
And I think this
one
is the
minute.
Best way.
Yeah,
this is the best way to go out. Jordan and I actually talked about it, that we could do a podcast called LA Incremental, which is just every single episode would be 1 minute of LA Confidential. And I was almost like, we were close, but too much movie is what it is now. You can totally do it. And I think that the tragedy of having a brand that so extensively covers our movies is that they just can't all be covered all at the same time. There's not enough me for the too much movies that are out there. So this is why we're doing it on this. I mean, lads, I think we've done it all. I mean, we've talked about Susan Lefford's mother, Mrs. Lefford's. We've done impressions. We've heard about Rob harassing people by a pool in Las Vegas. We've heard about Jordan being fearful of Elroy listing all of the words that can't be said on CBS. And Chris has illuminated to so many people about specifically Tomas Rahalis Jr.'s overdubbing Go F Your Mother as the great character actors. I mean, that's enough of too much movie. I think. Is there anything else that we need to say to wrap up? Anything else that is just on the tip of your tongue that has to be said before we wrap?
I think we should go around and say our one last thing, but I highly recommend if you can track down anything from the Shotgun Ride Los Angeles, or go look up Feast of Death on YouTube. That's definitely there. I think you'll get...
I'm going to put a link to that. It's Shotgun Freeway Drives Through Lost LA from 1995. Got Morgan Neville and Harry Pallenberger, the directors. And then that next one, James Ellroy's Feast of Death from 2001, directed by Vikram Jayanti.
Be with a loved one for that one, because it is creepy.
All about the Black Dahlia. Maybe even better than the Black Dahlia.
It is. Dahlia, 100%.
I will also link Jordan Harper's Black Dahlia review on Letterboxd to the show, just so that people can see that, because it's thoroughly enjoyable. But Rob, let's start with you, my friend. Anything else before we go, before we give the glamour back to the girls in Bisbee?
I mean, you know, I know everyone tries to see themselves in every movie. And the line that struck me in this was, when I came out to LA, this isn't exactly how I saw myself ending up. And, you know, wear that any way you want, but I'm just ready for someone to say, well, yeah, well, get in line. I love it. I could go on forever, but it's fun to talk about movies you love, and thanks for giving this platform for me to do it with such just smart, awesome dudes. It's I'm a big fan of all three of yours, and it's just a delight to be in an iPad with the three of you guys.
Jordan Harper, thank you so much for like literally unparalleled insights into this, and to Elroy, and to the pilot. I think the like pre. What is it like? It's right on the line, the like pre-Rampart LA in the 80s, Reagan's 80s, you know, LA Confidential. It's a lift and drop. There's shoulder pads. There's slightly different, like, weird celebrity lookalike hookers.
It is,
it's,
she,
it's all...
They cut me to look like
Lonnie
Anderson. She's
not Veronica Lake anymore.
You know? I can't imagine anybody's made it this far into this podcast without already having seen the movie. But, like, if you haven't, like, this is really, truly one of the great movies of the 90s. It's based on one of the great books in American crime fiction. My dog is named Elroy, which a lot of people know already. Helped me get the job. I do want, if I can say one last thing and turn it back to the pilot, which I hope someday, I can't do it myself, but if it were ever to leak and go public, I would not curse personally. And one of the reasons I wouldn't is because I think, you know, I'm proud of what I did, but I'm also really, really proud of the cast. And I talked about a little of them, but we were really gearing up, but not just Walton, you know, we talked about him already, but Tony Curran, who played Dudley Smith in my pilot. Tony Curran, if you've never seen him in Doctor Who, I don't even want to spoil what he does on Doctor Who, but it's one of the great performances on TV. We had, you know, Bruning and Carlisle, who are Dudley's goons. We had the amazing combination of my friend Drew Powell, who is a great big hulking guy who, you know, hands like catcher's mitts, and we paired him with Charles Barker, who was Skinny Pete on Breaking Bad, and they were gearing up to be the great evil buddy cop duo of television, which, by the way, evil buddy cop duo, somebody get at me. You know, Sarah Jones with one of the most difficult roles in the world to try and...
She was great.
Yeah, such a wonderful... Amazing. Brian J. Smith as Ed Exley. They were all amazing. It was, you know, I had to not read or watch this movie for a couple of years. And I just last year watched it again for the first time. And I'm glad that I'm learning to love again, you know, after, you know, we all have our things that got away. But like, man, this was, I was really looking forward to taking this all the way in. But if I can't, then at least this movie exists. And this movie is... nearly perfect. So I'm really glad that you guys had me on here, and it was great to talk about it with you guys.
Absolutely.
Lucky to have you, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is an audio wrecking ball. You want to help me swing it? Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.